Support for WMFE comes from Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University's worldwide campus, where highly ranked online degree programs offer the flexibility to learn what students want from wherever they are. More at erau.edu/worldwide.
Hope, inspiration, and possibility. Get ready to experience growing bolder because it might just change your life. Whether you've been thinking about changing jobs, maybe starting a hobby, taking an adventure vacation, making a lifestyle change, or stepping up to face personal or physical challenges, over the next hour, you'll find critical information and invaluable motivation.
And what a great hour it's going to be. In a minute, we're going to catch up with Carol Burnett's sidekick, Vicki Lawrence, will be here for a lively chat. And everybody knows you got to look your best to feel your best, right? Well, fashion guru Sharon Haver will explain how you don't have to break the bank to bring out a whole new you. Then we're going to meet a man who was blind for a decade. Get this, he had a tiny telescope implanted that helped him see again. Also, the incredible story of overcoming Tourette's. Folks, it's time to start growing bolder.
She, in fact, was discovered in a most unusual way at the age of 17, and she has been a star ever since. In fact, thanks to her years on The Carol Burnett Show, she's ingrained into the fabric of our entire culture. And how ironic that perhaps her most well-known character is needed more in society today, Bill, than ever before.
I know, because what would Mama do with Miley Cyrus these days? And we've got good news. For the first time ever, do you realize this? The TV classic Mama's Family is now available on DVD, and it's been a while. It seems unbelievable, but her career in showbiz and comedy and music and writing is now entering its fourth decade. Let's say hi to one of our favorites, the great Vicki Lawrence. How are you, Vicki?
I'm great. How are you guys doing?
Thrilled to have you and thrilled about the news. I mean, when you look back at some of the skits you did with Carol Burnett or any of the episodes of Mama's Family, and then you watch something from today, doesn't it seem there's something missing, something that used to be there but isn't anymore? Do you have any ideas what's different, what's changed?
Well, you know, it's funny. We were in New York City last week, and we went in to have dinner into this little restaurant, and the darling bartender was, I don't know, maybe she was 30. And she said, what are you guys doing in New York City? My husband said, well, we're here promoting the DVD set. Mama's Family has been released. And you saw her face. She put it all together in the span of about 4 seconds. And she went, oh, my God, you're Mama. And I said, yes. She said, oh, my God, back when comedy was good. She said, because everything now is a fart joke. And it's just so, she said, there's no depth to the comedy. There's no reality to the comedy anymore. Which, I don't know, I think, you know, a few of the comedies are getting it back together, but, yeah, it was back in the day when it was really well-written character comedy, you know.
So much has changed, you know, Vicki, not just the content, the type of comedy, but, you know, obviously the technology and the way it's developed. I mean, your show was spun off of the Carol Burnett Show at a really interesting time in television history, and it really did kind of put you up against the new guy in town. You're entering pretty much at the birth of cable TV.
Uh-huh. Yeah, very much so. We sort of were working almost in a vacuum. The first two seasons that are being released into retail right now were our NBC shows. But NBC, Joe Hamilton, our executive producer, who was Carol's husband, sold Mama's Family to Grant Tinker, who was the CEO of NBC. This is like, I know, television history lesson. Get your Google out quick, kids. But he was the CEO of NBC. He sold it to him on the golf course without a pilot. So we really had to figure out who Mama's Family was while we were on the ground running. And the young guys at NBC, I think, never really embraced a rural comedy, which they never have. And it, my God, what a mistake, because most of us are rural. And they didn't understand a young woman playing an older woman. So they just kept putting us in worst time slots until I think they felt like they sort of had the ammunition to cancel us. And then we sat for like a year and a half, and I think we all figured it was over, and we were all looking for new jobs. And it was right when Laura Marr merged with Telepictures. And Telepictures was the beginning of syndication and the beginning of really the beginning of cable. And they were looking for things to sell easily that they didn't have to develop. And they said, well, here's a show that was a hit that never got a shot. The demographic is amazing. We're going to put it back on the air. And it was a great way to work in that they were so busy selling the show, they didn't meddle. You know, we'd do a show, send it to them, and they'd send us a check. On the other hand, we weren't recognized by the Academy. We weren't really embraced by the television community. It was the very beginning of syndication and cable.
Yeah, and yeah. That sort of black hole you were in kind of continued up to now. I mean, why has it taken so long for the show to come out on DVD?
Well, you know, I don't know the answer to that. Every time I have asked over the years, because I say, oh, my God, my fans, everywhere I go, want to know why they can't get it on DVD, I get a no, it's not ever going to happen from everywhere that I go. And I just mentioned it in passing last year when we were putting together the Carol Burnett DVD. I mentioned it to Time Life because they do such a beautiful job. And I said, this would be my dream come true for Mama's Family. And they said, yeah, a lot of times there are extenuating circumstances or things that can't be cleared or legal issues or estates to deal with. And I'm like, yeah, tell me. And unbeknownst to me, they went to work on it, and they actually made it happen.
Isn't that cool?
So I know. So like about 6 months ago, I get this phone call, and they're like, we've made a deal with Warners. Who are you in touch with? We've got to get the cast together and do some bonus features. And I went, oh, my God, because the cast is scattered to four corners of the country. So I started making all those phone calls because I'd lost touch with everybody. And it's great. We've all gotten back in touch, and we did like a family reunion, and it was great. It was really great.
You know, Vicki, your career has been intertwined so much with that of Carol Burnett, and forgive me because you've no doubt told the story millions of times of how you met Carol. But just so people realize that long shots really can happen, can you tell it to us one more time?
Well, I was a senior in high school, and I entered a contest in my hometown. It was called Miss Fireball, and it was the local fireman's ball was coming up, and so they decided to, in order to get some girls there to sing and dance, they'd call it a contest. So about 2 weeks prior to the contest, our local newspaper gal wrote an article about the event and said that in the article she said that I bore a striking resemblance to a young Carol Burnett, and there was a picture of all the girls. And my mom looked at that, and I'd been told that I looked like Carol since I, you know, first started in high school. She said, write her a fan letter. And so I sat down and wrote her and told her I would love to meet her and enclosed that article with the picture. And it managed to make its way to her desk like a day or two prior to this contest. And she took my dad's name out of the article, found us in the phone book, and called me and made arrangements to come and see that contest. And she just, on a hunch, her husband thought she was nuts. They had just moved out from New York and were just in the process of starting to put together the Carol Burnett Show. And she said, I have a funny hunch about this. I want to go see her.
Wow.
And the rest is history. You know, the Miss Firecracker thing, that was a title of your autobiography that I read. I can remember it years ago. And the thing that brought out in that book that I remember, Vicki, is that here you did this great show about this family where everybody's yelling at each other. And I read that you had a very difficult upbringing in your own family. You know, people think that everything was handed to you on a platter because of that discovery, but you've really paid some dues. How have you managed to cope with all the disappointments as well as the highs in your life?
Oh, well, I don't really feel I had a disappointing upbringing. I just a little kind of a dysfunctional mother who was a little left of center, and I think probably most of us can relate to that. And I have a really good friend who's a psychologist who loves to tell me on occasion that anybody who says that they're not living in a dysfunctional family, Vicki, is living alone. So we're all, I think we're all in it together, and I think that's why Mama resonates, because we all have somebody in our family like that, you know, that just says the most terrible things. But somewhere under there, there's a little underlying truth.
You know, Vicki, Bill mentioned earlier in this interview Miley Cyrus. What would Mama's reaction be to Miley? If Miley was Mama's daughter, what would Mama say to her?
Good Lord, I don't know. Would she throw her in a room and spank her? I worry about it because I think she might enjoy it a little bit too much. I don't. I don't know. I don't know if Mama would punish her or if Mama would be up there learning to twerk with her. Although I think Mama's twerker's a little rusty.
See, that's why we need Mama back. And won't it be cool to see people seeing it for the first time?
Well, I think it is, and it's, you know, I'm on the road doing a show, and she's half of my show. I call it Vicki Lawrence and Mama, a two-woman show, and she's the second half of the show, and it's been great fun to just get her out of the closet and really put her in everybody's face because, you know, when has anybody ever seen her in person? And it's just great to me to watch the demographic in my audience and see how she has spanned the generations. So, I mean, and I say to everybody, go get the DVDs. If you remember the show, show them to your grandkids, and maybe, if nothing else, it'll make them appreciate their grandmother a little bit more.
Hey, Vic, in our last 30 seconds or so, what's the takeaway from you? What can we learn from what you've been through in your life?
What can you learn? Well, I mean, my motto is life is much too serious to be taken seriously, and I really think that's true. I think you need to keep your sense of humor and laugh. Otherwise, you'll slit your wrists, you know. And then if you're a mother like I am, you're the one that's going to have to clean up the mess. So I think it's always best to keep laughing.
From all the great roles that you've had on stage, from the music and all the skits that we remembered, you know, deep inside ourselves, we want to thank you, Vicki, for enduring what you have and celebrating the victories that you have, and remind people that you can find DVDs of Mama's Family wherever DVDs are sold. And you can keep up with all things Vicki Lawrence, because she's pretty busy out there, at VickiLawrence.com. Thanks so much.
Stay connected to Growing Boulder for daily doses of hope, inspiration, and possibility. Find us on YouTube, TikTok, Facebook, and Instagram for our latest stories, reels, and motivational memes. Time now for a GB Classic. We've interviewed a guy named Sean Swarner a number of times, including once from the summit of Mount McKinley, which is now known as Denali. Call it what you will, it is the highest peak in North America. We interview Sean because his story is beyond interesting, his message incredibly important. This is a guy who was diagnosed with two terminal cases of cancer as a teenager, once at 13, again at 16, he was read his last rites, given a prognosis of 14 days to live. But of course, that's not how it ended. Sean was in a medically induced coma for a year, and he emerged with a passion for adventure and a desire to give others hope. He went on to become the first cancer survivor to summit Mount Everest, which of course is the highest peak in the world. He's the only person in history to climb the highest mountain on every continent, to trek to South and North Poles, to complete the Hawaii Ironman, and to do it all with just one lung. Here's a snippet of our conversation with Sean Swarner. Let's tell folks where you came from, Sean. You mentioned the fact that you've got one lung. I mean, that only tells part of the story. At age 13, you had stage 4 non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and doctors gave you, what, 3 months to live?
Yeah, I was 13, and the doctors gave me 3 months to live, which, you know, isn't exactly a prognosis that people want to hear. Especially being only 13 years old, because, you know, I was on the cusp of my life. You know, my hormones were kicking in, my friends were out chasing girls, having a great time, and I was battling for my life.
And somehow you battled through that, Sean. I mean, it's incredible, only to, at 16, a totally different cancer comes in, creates a huge tumor in your lungs, and then you're given 2 weeks to live and last rites?
Exactly. It's crazy how things happened. I was going in for a checkup for the first cancer, and they found on an x-ray from just a checkup a golf ball-sized tumor on my right lung. And in one day, they found a tumor. They did a needle biopsy. They took out a lymph node. They put in a Hickman catheter. They cracked open my ribs, took out the tumor, put in a drainage tube, and started chemotherapy in less than one day.
And after that, I mean, isn't there a part of you that just wants to sit on the couch like you are now and not do anything else? I mean, what is responsible for you deciding that the world now is your adventure?
Well, you know, you go through some traumatic illness. For me, it was cancer. And you can look at it one of two ways. You can be angry at the world for what you went through, or you can accept the fact that, you know, everyone in life goes through some hardships, some trials, some tribulations. And I chose to look at it differently and see life through a different set of eyes, see them through, you know, rose-colored lenses, and try to give back and do something with my life, and realize that, you know, I didn't necessarily do anything to get the cancer. It wasn't my fault. You know, I didn't smoke 18 packs of cigarettes a day. Who knows? And my goal now is I just want to show people what's truly possible with the human body and spirit. And, you know, I with a prognosis of, like you said, 3 months, 14 days, I've read my last rites, I have one functioning lung, and being the first cancer survivor to summit Everest, I use the highest platform in the world to give people something I never had, which is hope.
You don't give the rest of us much of a reason to say no, do you?
You know, I never was big into excuses.
And boy, we got a million of them these days. What was it that made you say, you know, okay, what, like Mark pointed out, not only are you going to survive this thing, but you are going to make a statement with your life from here on out?
No, I think it was just a combination of a bunch of things. I'm alive because of, you know, modern medicine, family support, prayer, and just an inner will to keep moving. And I wanted to, like I said, give people hope. You know, I have a saying that the human body can live for roughly 30 days without food. The human condition can sustain itself for about 3 days without water. But no human alive can survive for more than 30 seconds without hope, because without hope, we truly have nothing.
Boy, he is so right. We can't live without hope. Sean, by the way, is now 47. He's a successful entrepreneur, a motivational speaker, and he is still chasing adventure.
Up next, meet the strongest librarian in the world. That's coming up next on Growing Bolder.
Embrace the health and longevity movement with the Fountain of Youth monthly e-newsletter. Growing Bolder and the National Senior Games Association have teamed up to bring you the latest videos, podcasts, and articles on inspirational masters athletes and the many benefits of physical activity delivered right to your inbox. Just go to nsga.com/connect to sign up for free today. The Fountain of Youth, because if you want to keep moving, you have to keep moving.
You are listening to Growing Bolder. Our next guest, folks, describes himself as, quote, just some guy. But man, is he wrong about that. He's a guy who has learned to face some pretty overwhelming obstacles head on. We love that. He struggled his entire life to simply fit in, to try to understand why he's different, and to try to live any kind of normal life.
You know, he suffers from Tourette's, but a very severe form of it. He has ever since he was six. His face twitches, his body will spasm, he shouts out words, he punches himself, but he's also made himself a success. His incredible story is documented in a book you gotta read called The World's Strongest Librarian. Let's say hi to Josh Hanegarn. Hey, Josh, how are you?
I'm great, guys. Thank you.
Josh, the world's strongest librarian?
You know what? I get called out constantly all the time on that. At the bottom of it, I just think it's a funny title, but I am pretty strong. I may very well be the strongest librarian, but I also like to get people stirred up by saying it's true.
All right, we definitely want to find out more about that, but talk about Tourette's. What has it been like for you to grow up with this, you know, it's a bizarre disease?
You know, growing up honestly wasn't that big of a deal because it didn't really go berserk until I was 20. So, you know, from age 6 to 20, roughly, it was just more of a nuisance. And for anyone listening who's not familiar with Tourette's, at its core, it's a neurological disorder. It makes people move involuntarily and vocalize involuntarily. That can look and sound like a lot of different things. So growing up, it was kind of a nuisance, but it didn't hurt me. And then when I was 20, that's when it really got bad, and the movements got bigger, and I started to actually have injuries. But that kind of brings us up to speed.
Josh, how old are you?
I'm almost 36, and today at age 36, it's far worse than it ever was at any time I wrote about during the book.
Man, I want to talk more about how you're handling that, but I ask your age because of this. You know, I'm 62 now, and it's a terrible disease, but I guess if there is good news here, we're more aware of it now than ever. I remembered, and I'm sure almost everybody my age remembers kids in school growing up that had this weird affliction that we didn't know about, our parents didn't know about it, and it must have made it tougher back then to have what you have, but not have anybody understand it.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, then as now, not as much as we'd like to know is known about it. But it was pretty hard. It's a really hard thing when you see somebody doing something that just looks like a behavior, and they just say, "Well, can't you stop?" And it's a funny question because, I mean, if I could stop, it would be the last thing I would be doing. So, yeah, I mean, as a kid, it wasn't that big of a deal. I don't want it to sound like I had it harder than other kids. It pretty much just sucks for everybody at times. My problem was, with the same insecurities as any other kid, I still called attention to myself without wanting to. So I never really got to just blend in when that was what I wanted.
Then you talked about it hitting and getting worse in your 20s, and it was even harder to blend in because you happened to be 6'7". So
yeah.
Here you are, you're, I guess, in your mid-20s, depressed, rightfully so, feeling kind of worthless, and something happened that changed everything for you. What was that?
Well, there were a couple of things. The main thing was that I got into strength training, and it was that I suddenly had a time every day where I felt like I was in control of my body. And there's been a bit of a misconception that the weights has made the tics better for me. It generally makes them worse. But what it does give me is a type of progress I can measure. And it's hard not to feel more confident when you're always getting better at something. For me, it just happened to be the weights. And it happens to be the thing where I can now say, I have a short time every day where I get to win a little bit, and I can feel in control of my body, and it makes me look big and scary.
Folks, you're listening to Josh Hanegarn, who has been struggling with Tourette's syndrome his entire life. He's written a fascinating new book called The World's Strongest Library. Josh was writing this, you know, part therapy, but also part trying to get a message out there. What do you want readers to take away from your book?
Honestly, what I would like the most is I'm very pro self-improvement, but I hate the self-improvement industry. I don't like people who tell you they know exactly what you should be doing with your life. This is not a book full of answers. It is a book with lots of questions you can ask yourself. And the main thing for me is that I've given up on the idea that I know what I should expect. What I believe is that every situation can be improved. That's it. And when you're in a situation you can't control, and we will all have them and have them again, the only thing you can do is introduce something into it that you can control. And that might be the best you can do, but there's always a way to move forward because there's always another question to ask. You just may have to redefine your ideas about what you are owed or what is fair and give up on the idea of how life was going to be for you at times.
You know, Josh, I think you just hit the nail on the head from Mark's question there, and it's that this book is not for other people with Tourette's. This book is for anybody who's ever felt like they don't fit in, who doesn't know what they want to do for a living, who struggles in figuring out what their life is all about. That's what your book is all about.
I hope so. I mean, not everybody knows Tourette's. Not everybody knows what it's like to leave the Mormon church, which is a small part of the book. Not everybody knows what it's like to learn the kind of strength stuff that I can do. But everybody understands ouch, and ouch is a big part of it, without being exhibitionist about it and saying, oh, look how screwed up I am, and I did it. And the reason I can do it is because I don't feel like I've overcome anything. I'm still in the thick of it, but we all are. And, you know, if you decide you're going to be part of this world, all you can decide after that is how you're going to react to what comes.
So how are you going to react in the next decade or so? Do you know what you will be like in 10 years? You mentioned that in your mid-30s, your condition is worse than it has ever been. Has it stabilized? Is there hope for you that it will go away at some point?
I just don't know. When I sold this book, it was a book about how I had cured myself. I was really in the middle of a full year without any tics, and I thought I had done it. I'd figured a lot of things out. While writing the book, it all roared back. And today, like I said, I'm at a point where for me, it's cracking bones, it's hernias, it's breaking teeth. It's really bad. And I think it's equally likely that I'll get worse every day and they'll rename it after me, or that I'll figure something else out and I'll get another year off. I just don't know. So as far as hope, what most people consider hope just sounds to me like waiting. And if you say, I hope this stops soon, I don't see how that's different than saying, when will this stop? And just wondering. So for me, there has to be an action attached to it. Because with Tourette's, you don't get to spend a lot of time thinking about yesterday or tomorrow, because you're trapped in this moment living tick to tick. So all you can really do is choose what's going to be right in front of you in that moment. And for me, that is always something I can improve at. I want my obsessions and my distractions to be things that leave me better, since I am trapped with them. So that's what gives me hope, but that's been the biggest change, is I feel like I actually understand what hope is now. Hope has an action attached to it. And maybe that doesn't make me get me everything or anything I want, but I can be better. And that's, it's not fair, but life is fair, not fair. And that I feel like is the best I can do. And it's liberating to be able to say that now.
You know, it's just the tip of the iceberg. This is one fascinating guy. And you can learn more about him and check out the book at worldsstrongestlibrarian.com. What a great interview, Josh. Good luck to you, and we'll check in with you again. Josh Hanegarn has been our guest, and really pointing us in the right direction. Up next, because of macular degeneration, he lost his eyesight he thought would be forever until something incredible happened. This is Growing Bolder. Sign up for the Growing Bolder Insider newsletter, delivered to your inbox every week. Be the first to see our latest interviews, stories, and tips for making each day count. Sign up today at growingbolder.com. Miss an episode of Growing Bolder Radio? Subscribe to our podcast and get it on your mobile device. Details at growingbolder.com/podcasts. No getting around it. Age can be a cruel and heartless beast. Here's a statistic for you. In this country, there are over 15 million people over the age of 60 losing their eyesight to macular degeneration. But you know, Mark, fortunately, these days, age can also be a time of discovery, hope, and possibility.
A cruel and heartless beast?
Isn't it?
My
Isn't
goodness.
It?
Yeah. This guy, folks, actually went legally blind from macular degeneration, lived that way for a little less than 10 years, but then something remarkable happened. He learned about a new surgical treatment option where he, in effect, had a tiny telescope smaller than a pea implanted into his eye. And guess what? Well, not only can he now see, he can recognize faces 20 feet away, he can work on a computer, and now at the age of 81, he can even snow ski. Let's say hello to Dan Dunbar. Hi, Dan.
Hi.
Man, talk about recapturing a lifestyle. What an incredible story. So you can ski. I'm guessing it's just a little bunny slope with the beginners?
Well, no, I managed to go down a black diamond 2 years ago, and I'm waiting for a little more snow, and we'll maybe go do it again this year.
The guy is shredding the black diamonds with a telescope in his eye. Welcome to the new century. Man, it's had to have made a huge difference, not just for you, but for your family, too. I mean, you're not just on the sidelines anymore. You're in the game.
Yes, I am.
And what does that mean to you, Dan? You lived a totally different world for a decade.
Yeah, it means a lot, because I was the way it was before. I was losing sight sort of like every day, although you measure it more in months, but it was not improving. It was getting worse. And now it's made a big change, and I can do the things that I couldn't do before.
So tell us about this procedure that you had? Because macular degeneration has become something that all baby boomers fear. You know, you read about it almost every day. It's something we all hope to avoid. What is this procedure, and were we right? Do you have a telescope in your eye?
Yes, it is a telescope. It's a three-power telescope, and it was implanted by a very well-known surgeon. They have these teams all over the country now. And the procedure, you know, I'm not a doctor, so I don't really know the details of it, but the way it's been explained to me, the procedure is very much like cataract surgery in that the cataract lens is removed and a new one put in. And that's really what they did. And it took about 90 minutes, and there was almost no effect. I mean, I couldn't see for a little while because they had it dilated for a while. But once they pulled the dilation, then, boy, you know, I got a nice big scene of what I used to not be able to see.
Can you explain, Dan, what was that like? I mean, I can almost see the Hollywood movie right now where they unwrap the bandages and the actor opens his eye.
It didn't quite like that. They put a bandage on for a little while, and then, in an hour or so, I think I had it taken off. The eye was functional. There was no pain. They had it deadened, of course, but it still was, just sort of like it was before. And there was a blurry image because I was dilated. And then as the dilation was removed, then I could begin to see, and I had this nice vision of things from quite a distance. It was really close.
I understand that they were thinking of replacing the Hubble with the Dan Dunbar.
Well, it's not that kind of power. It's only three times. But, things now appear in the eye one-third the distance that they truly are.
It's amazing.
Folks, this is Dan Dunbar, who was legally blind from macular degeneration, an ailment that millions suffer from, until he had a telescope implanted into his eye. As he's told us, it's a 3X telescope. And Dan, I don't mean to make light of this, but you probably got one of the first versions. Can it be upgraded? Can you go from 3X to 5X to 10X? Is it autofocus? Are there going to be new models for you?
Well, I don't think for me. And as far as it's a fixed focus lens, and so it's very well centered. I didn't have to worry about seeing things at a different angle than I had before. It was right dead on, and so they prescribe corrective lenses to be able to see close, because if you're looking at something and it's three times away, it doesn't work so well when it's close. So they give a set of glasses, and it corrects all that. And now I can see things really close, very well. I don't have, I used to like to do my woodworking, and I couldn't really do it because I couldn't read the scales, and I couldn't do various things. Now I can read it very clearly.
And how about that, Dan? Here you are, 81 years old. I mean, you've got your daughters and your grandsons there, and you're back mm-hmm. doing things with them that really you couldn't do before. You've got your life back, Dan.
No, I used to get lost in the ski slopes, by the way, because I couldn't see far enough to really determine where the run went. So now that's not a problem. I can see all the way down the end of the run. I can see people, and I can recognize my daughter from several hundred feet away. So life is good. It really is good. You see movies. Movies are absolutely astounding. When you can't see them before and now you can see them, it's just super. So one thing I had to learn was to look at people directly in the face, because macular degeneration means you look at the periphery. And so it's nice to be able to see people's eyes again and what they look like, and it's just marvelous.
All right, Dan, we're going to leave it right there. And, folks, I know you've got questions about the procedure that he had. You'd like to learn more information. You can find out more by going to CentraSite.com. That's CentraSite.com. Our thanks to Dan Dunbar. And, Bill, isn't that one of the great things about this new day and age? You know, folks, no matter how bad you might have it, hang in there because there are technological advances every day that impact our lives in many ways. Here's a guy that went from being legally blind to having his world returned. Turn to him.
And he is not the only one. I mean, you hear all the time about people having knees replaced. What kind of an age are we living in? You can have your hip replaced, your elbows, your shoulders, now your eyesight as well. Folks, there is no reason not to be as active as you want to be, as active as you dare to be, no matter how old you are. You've got to keep working, keep living, keep being active.
Yeah, because sooner or later, there's going to be an advancement that will enable you to return to what you used to do. So the takeaway here, folks, is to get yourself in shape, stay in shape, live an active life, and who knows, what you once lost may be returned to you. You mentioned these knees, Bill. They're not just building knees now. They're building titanium knees that we've seen, and we've talked to guys who have climbed Mount Everest on artificial knees.
It's amazing. We live in an era, folks, of no excuses. Think about that as you plan the rest of your day. Our thanks to Dan Dunbar and the telescope of all things in his eye. Anything's possible, folks. Get out there and start growing bolder. Up next, one of the most respected voices in fashion today on how you can turn the latest glamour trends into something realistic for you. This is Growing Bolder.
Stay connected to Growing Bolder for daily doses of hope, inspiration, and possibility. Find us on YouTube, TikTok, Facebook, and Instagram for our latest stories, reels, and motivational memes. Most of us tend to think of exercise as something that the body does. We measure effort by sweat. And if physical limitations arise when we get older, we accept that our days of working out are behind us. But the brain doesn't stop needing a workout just because the body slows down. And the good news is that the brain has its own gym. Simple conversation is, in fact, heavy lifting. It involves listening closely, thinking on your feet, interpreting emotion, reading facial expression, choosing words, responding in real time. Now, that's not passive. That is training. That's some of the most complex work that the human brain does. It doesn't build muscle. It builds neural pathways. And then there's what's known as micro-socialization. The smallest social interactions that we have, or at least we can have every day, no matter our physical limitations. A smile, a nod, eye contact, a brief exchange with a stranger. Now, science confirms that these moments are not insignificant. They do support brain health. So if conversation is heavy lifting for the brain, then micro-socialization is cardio, keeping the mind alert, responsive, and connected. And belief magnifies the impact because the brain responds to meaning. When we believe engagement matters, it does more than just stimulate, it strengthens. When we believe connection counts, it compounds. Belief doesn't change how we feel. It changes how the brain works. So don't say you can't work out, because that's a cop-out. If you're listening, if you're noticing, responding, connecting, if you're engaging with others, even in micro-socializations, you are working out. You're training the most important organ in your body. And if you believe the benefits of that training, well, the impact will be even greater. Growing Bolder isn't about lifting heavier weights. It's about lifting expectations. It's about understanding that effort comes in many forms. And sometimes the most powerful exercise that we have is simply showing up, looking up, saying hello, and engaging in conversation.
The
Here's the question for you folks. How do you dress? Pretty well? Could you use a little pick-me-up? Well, when it comes to fashion these days, perhaps more than ever, there is a real difference between looking like you and looking like you're trying to avoid looking like you. And nobody knows the business of beautiful quite like our next guest.
You got that right. She's the fashion guru for Macy's, the writer of the column Focus on Style, syndicated in major papers around the world. She's an on-air radio and TV fashion expert who has styled everybody from Kelly Ripa to Elle McPherson. And it's her passion to empower everyone with the know-how to look their best. Let's welcome style guru Sharon Haver to the program. How are you, Sharon?
I'm great. How are you two handsome guys doing?
Well, we're going to be a lot more handsome at the end of this interview, I have a feeling.
Oh, good.
So, Sharon, what did you want to talk about today?
Well, I wanted to talk about something that's really important to my readers on FocusOnStyle.com and really important to me, and it's the idea of achieving ageless style, ageless chic, rather than being stuck and concerned in the age-appropriate geezer ghetto, as I like to call it. Because I think when you get trapped in saying, can I wear this at 40, at 50, at 60, you put all these false kind of limits on yourself and a ceiling that you end up being afraid to be vital, to take chances. And if you strive to look ageless, you're really striving to look gorgeous for the skin you're in today, regardless of the year you were born, because that's just a number.
You say that, Sharon, and man, I agree with it totally, but it's going to be misunderstood by some people because there are women who, at any cost, don't want to appear as though they look like they're trying to be 18 or 20. Real fashion
right.
is ageless, but there are some mistakes that women can make that they shouldn't, aren't there?
Yeah, one of the things is getting trapped in wearing teenage clothes. So they'll say, well, I can't wear a short skirt because a teenager would. But yes, you can wear a short skirt if you have fantastic legs and you're in proportion, if it's a sophisticated style. If you're going to start going for a frilly baby doll look or, you know, a little pleated kilt or something baby pink, yeah, you're going to look kind of stupid as an old person trying too hard. So it's keeping a look that's cleaner and sophisticated and not being stuck in a trend that's otherwise geared to a specific age group.
Now, speaking of specific age groups, you know, the fashion industry always ignored, I guess you could say, people over 50. But boy, is that changing. Diane Keaton, Sharon Stone, Christie Brinkley, Susan Sarandon, and more. These people now have big endorsement deals.
Yeah, and did you see, I don't know if any of you are on Focus on Style on my Facebook page, but I wrote a whole article last week about how to look ageless, and one of the examples I used was how gorgeous Christie Brinkley looks. And she actually gave me this massive shout-out on her Facebook page, and it's true, and it's just, you know, and it's great. You look good, you try hard to look beautiful and confident, and that doesn't matter what year you were born.
All right, Sharon, here, I hear people screaming at the radio right now saying, of course Christie Brinkley looks good. She's got all the money in the world. She's got the best stylist in the world. She's got everybody around her. But what can the regular working person do to look their best?
I just think that's a load of, can I say it, C-R-A? Asterisk P. I've been using wrinkle cream since I'm 16, you know, and my favorite wrinkle cream is from Avon. Thank you very much. Avon, ladies. I was on the first photo shoot for the launch for Anew, and I use it religiously, and that's not expensive. It's what you make of it, and more important, it's the excuses. You don't need a stylist if you have good taste. You know, you just need to understand what works on you, and that's my whole principle behind FocusOnStyle.com. Someone who's stylish knows how to take what's in their closet and rework it to suit them. You don't have to go out buying clothes. Even though I was a stylist for 15 years, I think the whole idea of the excuse of thinking you need a personal stylist is just ridiculous. Since we're all about 6 years old, we get dressed and we dress ourselves every day, like big girls and big boys. So you might as well learn how to do it right for yourself and not depend on someone else. That's some fairy tale that came from, you know, watching too many reality TV shows. You really need to know what works best on you and work it. You're your own personal stylist when you learn how.
Folks, we're talking with Sharon Haver, who is one of the top stylists in Hollywood, talking about having an ageless chic style as you age. Sharon, in our business, we get frustrated by the fact that advertisers mostly care about the younger viewers and the younger listeners. In fashion, I'm guessing that the major manufacturers, the really good designers, mostly want to see their clothes on 18 to 25-year-olds as well. Is that changing? Are the really good design houses starting to provide some options for women over 50 to dress in this ageless chic, which you describe, or do they have to make it up themselves?
No, absolutely. I mean, designers aren't stupid. The people who have the money to buy the clothes aren't 18 to 24 unless their parents is buying it. You know, the people who have the money to buy the clothes are older, who are working, who are, you know, successful. So, but it's not a matter of a good designer or a bad designer. There's a million designers. It's a matter of training your eye to hone in on and seeing what works for you. And if you go in a store and you're looking for something that's a little more simply cut and, you know, flatters maybe a belly or, you know, a not such a taut body, you won't see all the little pink frilly dresses because you're not even looking for them. They're not right for you. So it's really training your eye to best seek out what suits you, regardless of the price or the sale rack or not.
Sharon, you have so much passion for this. It just comes across. You know, most of the stylist people that we get on the program, well, they're all happy talking about you. You really come out full force because this is your passion, a love of style, and you had a fabulous career in the glamour industry. Personally, can I ask you, how many times did you feel like giving up? How many times, because everybody in the world wants to do what you do, what gave you the courage to think you could do it and to keep trying?
My mother, she raised me in Lomans. I learned how to find good clothes looking on a sale rack with the labels cut out by the seaming. You know, my mother always told me that, you know, you always wear the best quality you can. And you always wear things that are classic. And every time, you know, growing up, I'd wear something that she would call crazy, she would have a big fit. So I knew that if I wanted to wear anything that was crazy, I had to go get a part-time job and buy it myself because she certainly wasn't going to do it. And I think, you know, and it's part of growing. And I get so annoyed with what, when media and people put all these false expectations on themselves. And really, at the end of the day, you're responsible for yourself. So just, you know, accept it and learn. And that's about style and everything else. You know, you need to learn to take the best care of yourself that you can and then know that you're trying, because once you give up the hope, you give up all the vitality and it's boring. So don't give up hope on yourself. You know, just keep making the best you can.
We're down to the final minute. Give us a tip. What's the first thing that listeners can do? You say know your body, be able to look. How do we get started in this process of learning how to dress in an ageless way?
Well, you can come to focusonstyle.com, and I have a free ageless chic and age-appropriate style guide. So you can follow my tips on how not to look old on the website. But more important, I think find someone who's your sort of style icon. And there's certainly so many beautiful women out there. And, you know, like I was just looking at Mary Steenburgen on a TV show earlier, and she's gorgeous. And, you know, she's not 12. And note when you find women who are attractive or men, what draws you to them, and it's usually that they're wearing clothes that are a little more simple. I'm not saying dumpy. I'm saying simple. It's less exaggerated details and more ones that when you look at the person themselves, it's the whole look that makes them stand out and look attractive. It's not like, oh, wow, I love her jacket, or, oh, wow, I love her lipstick. It's, oh, wow, she looks great. And understanding that.
And your attitude stands out so far above the rest. Check her out, focusonstyle.com. Our thanks once again to style expert Sharon Haver.
We've heard from some pretty impressive people on this program, so now it's time to take a minute to think about you. What's your Growing Bolder story? What do you want it to be? Think about it, craft it, and then find a way to start living it.
Stop trying to define people by their age alone. It's a whole new world out there where it's not about age, it's about attitude, and that's Growing Bolder.
The Growing Bolder radio show is a production of Growing Bolder, LLC, all rights reserved. This program was recorded at Growing Bolder Studios in Orlando and is available as a weekly podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Spotify, and TuneIn. It is written and produced by Jill Middleton, Mark Middleton, and Bill Schaefer. Technical director is Jason Morrow. Production manager is Michael Nanis. And our most important team member, you. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram to keep growing bolder every day.